Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow is the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens. His work, of course, is so widely read now, and it really transcends time and language and culture. There are a lot of celebrations going on. There's going to be a wreath-laying ceremony tomorrow in Poets' Corner, Westminster Abbey, which will include readings from Dickens' novels and his other writings. The Dean of Westminster, Reverend John Hall, said, "Dickens' humanity and compassion made an extraordinary impact on Victorian England through his writings, which remain immensely popular. This bicentenary should help renew our commitment to improving the lot of the disadvantaged and in our own day." And we're going to be talking about his childhood, his incredibly prolific life. He just wrote so much and probably worked himself to death. He, of course, was nobody's a simple person. Dickens, of all people, was a highly complicated man. And we'll talk about how complicated he was. And I'm interested in hearing from you the works that you read, because he's one of those writers, I think, when you read him, most of us in high school, you just are captivated. For me, it was Great Expectations, and I reread that book during summer vacation last year and remembered why I was captivated by him and by his writing. So there's something, we all have favorite works, I think, by Dickens. Feel free to call in with your questions about his life or comments on his work or the impact that he had on making us think about the disadvantaged among us. Our guest this hour is Martin Fido. Martin is currently senior lecturer, arts and sciences writing program at Boston University. He is the author of The World of Charles Dickens, which has just been republished because of this important year. It was written in 1996. He has written a number of books on Jack the Ripper, the new Jack the Ripper A to Z. He has taught in many different locations. He is from England originally. And he has taught at the University of West Indies. He's taught in the Barbados. He was active in theater and educational broadcasting in the West Indies. He was a freelance writer and broadcaster specializing in true crime, broadcast a weekly radio program called Murder After Midnight on London's LBC radio from 87 to 2001. He came to the United States and settled in Cape Cod in the year 2000. And he has been teaching writing and research at Boston University. He's taught at other universities as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Martin Fido. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm very happy to be with you.
Do you remember? I remember so vividly. Maybe I had a great teacher in high school, but the book Great Expectations just grabbed me. It's one of those books that I think changed me in a way that heightened an interest in a certain kind of character, a certain kind of living condition, whether or not there was justice in the world. It was just an important book in my life.
Well, the important Dickens experience in my life came when I was seven.
Seven.
And I was taken to see the Freddie Bartholomew version of David Copperfield with the wonderful W.C. Fields performance of Mr. Micawber. And that inspired me to go home and read it, after which I read Oliver Twist, after which I read Nicholas Nickleby. I read The Christmas Carol. I didn't read Great Expectations till sometime after that, mm-hmm. but it meant that I was well into Dickens before I was 10.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, we had a good edition with the Fizz illustrations, and they had been colored in, so it was fun for a child to read.
One thing that you look at the amount of work that he generated in a relatively short life, and it was unbelievable, wasn't it? He worked and worked and worked.
He was undoubtedly a workaholic, and when you add to the writing and the stress which that often put on him, especially when he was writing in weekly rather than monthly parts, because, of course, all his novels were written in serial form, you add to that the social activities he was involved in. I mean, the help that he gave to the heiress Angela Bernadette Coutts in her home for fallen women, he worked very hard on that. And then the amateur theatricals. He loved acting, but this was a huge amount of work added to everything. He was a real workaholic.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about his early life, because all accounts show that the experience in the blacking factory really haunted him, and we see that in so many of his works.
Yes, it certainly did, especially when you consider that his early childhood had been very happy. In his early childhood, he lived in Kent. He was born, in Southampton. Or near Southampton in Portsea. And after that, his family moved to Chatham, where the naval docks were. His father was a clerk in the Navy office. And he loved the walks in Kent. He always loved Kent. His father was clearly a delightful man to be with when you were a child. He was rather flamboyant. He was like Mr. Micawber, but that was fun for a child. And his mother, it seems, had a creative imagination and gave Dickens the idea of telling stories. And then suddenly, John Dickens, his father, is transferred to London. They go to live in Camden Town. There's no longer beautiful countryside around. They're in a city which Dickens didn't find attractive. They're close to a rather nasty slum area, which he uses to some extent in Little Dorrit. And then, when he's 12... his father's incapacity to live within his income catches up with him. He goes into the Marshalsea prison for debt, and Dickens is forced to work in a blacking factory, sticking labels onto bottles of boot blacking, and made to work in the window so that passers-by can see him, because the boys were thought to work so fast and it was entertaining to watch them.
I didn't know that.
He felt totally humiliated. He was ambitious. He was a great reader. He'd been reading The Arabian Nights, The Tales of the Genii, lots of the 18th century novels, Fielding, Smollett. He saw the possibility of himself being a great man, and he saw it gone. He expected to be reduced to being a worker. And although he himself, in many ways, attacked the class system, he also felt it very strongly. He felt that he had the right to make his way in the world, to become a person of distinction, that he felt had been taken away from him. It was so embarrassing to him that it wasn't till well into his adult life that he ever mentioned it to any of his friends, and then he only mentioned it to his very closest friend, John Forster.
Mm. And is it true that his father and his brothers came to him repeatedly for money because this pattern, their pattern of not being able to make it financially in the world, they thought he had, so they wanted some of his riches?
This is absolutely true, though I think you make them sound a little bit more grasping than they were. They were really incompetent. His father was charming, hardworking, a little bit pompous, entertaining, and utterly hopeless with money.
Uh-huh.
And for many years after Dickens became a success, he was hopefully sponging off him, using his name improperly and saying, my son will look after that. And then, when Dickens started a newspaper, became the first editor of the Daily News, it didn't last in that for long, his father, who'd already learnt shorthand and had made Dickens become a writer by having him learn shorthand and start as a parliamentary reporter, his father became the organizer of the reporters, moved to London from Dickens. Dickens had moved him to Devonshire to get him out of the way because he borrowed so much. He came back to London, worked hard, was admired by his colleagues, and remained out of debt for the rest of his life.
Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
It's so hard to imagine when you describe these monthly or weekly installments that people in Victorian England were reading by Dickens. It's so hard to imagine that in 2012, isn't it? But it would indicate that the public was reading a lot, that they were somewhat educated. Were they popular? And why were they popular?
They were immensely popular with the reading classes. Now, they're coming out monthly, made them more attractive.
Mm.
Think of Downton Abbey. Those who are hooked on Downton Abbey are not going to miss it every week. And in the same way, those who were hooked on a Dickens novel, and he always ended with a cliffhanger point, or usually ended with a cliffhanger point, what's going to happen next? They really were looking forward to what would come out. In America, they would actually wait at the quays in New York for the vessels on which they knew the boat was coming in. And it said when the old curiosity shop was coming to an end, and they knew that clearly it looked as though little Nell was going to die, the crowds were supposed to have shouted to the ship, "Is Nelly dead?"
Oh, my goodness. What a story. What a story.
So, yes, they loved it. But then there's the wider popularity. And this, the great American scholar Richard Altick established, rather interestingly, gave Dickens popularity not for what he wrote, but for what the plagiarizers and imitators wrote for him. His first big success was the Pickwick Papers, and that was a huge success. It caused a Pickwick rage, which was like Beatlemania. Pickwick was used to sell everything. There were no copyright of ideas in those days. And judges on the bench were reading him. It was said that a dying man was told by his physician that he'd only got a month to live, and he said, "Well, at least the next number of Pickwick will come out." But down at the area where you had the illiterate working classes who couldn't read, there were shilling-a-line writers, penny-a-line writers, producing cheap imitations of Pickwick. Hmm. Now, in the Pickwick Papers, of course, Mr. Pickwick is the great benevolent figure, but his Cockney servant, Sam Weller, is a very popular character, rescues him from scrapes. But Mr. Pickwick is the fine, benevolent figure at the center. Now, in the popularized versions, Mr. Pickwick was a silly old man, and Sam Weller was really the hero. And these were changed. Also, Dickens was confronted with dramatizations of these serials before he'd completed them. So people would get them on the stage, and he'd find to his horror that people were inventing endings which either were exactly what he wanted to surprise the public with, or, annoyingly, were exactly what he wouldn't have wanted to be associated with.
Hmm. I've always found that he had such a gift, I think, for description, Martin, that you read some of the lovely and inventive descriptions of human beings, and by golly, you can imagine them in your mind's eye effortlessly.
You can indeed, but he always writes with this wonderful sense of exaggeration and look for the oddity. And
yes,
it's great fun after reading Dickens to go out on, say, the underground, or on a bus, or just walking through a shopping mall, and start looking at people with Dickens' eye.
Mm-hmm.
And think how he would describe these people and how he would pick out every possible eccentricity and oddity. And there's plenty of it to see.
Yeah. What about this idea of, we have to talk about his time, the Industrial Revolution, his thoughts and attitudes, and whether or not he was espousing a kind of activism through his writing, and what that activism might be?
Interesting and very complicated. All the literate Southern English Victorians viewed the Industrial Revolution with a degree of concern and anxiety. Even Disraeli, the Conservative Prime Minister, he was writing social novels looking at what had happened. It was he who said, there are two nations in England, the rich and the poor. Disraeli would happily have gone for the 99% and 1% and said, yeah, we shouldn't have that sort of divide. That was conservatism in England at that time. Now, they all agreed that the dirt and smoke created by industrialism was a problem. The road between Birmingham, where you had the big metal works, and Wolverhampton, where you had the big pottery works, had forges and factories on either side, and several writers described with amazement this scene of belching smoke, fires which were blazing at night, great slag heaps. Dickens describes it in The Old Curiosity Shop. That's a sense that this new approach has brought ugliness. Furthermore, in Hard Times, Dickens then looks at a northern mill town and says, you know, the machinery is, in one sense, one point, he says, the machine working, going up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of monotonous, melancholy madness. It must be something like the sort of oil drill you can sometimes see with small oil rigs. So they look with horror at the ugliness. They look with concern at the exploitation of workers. But, again, in Hard Times, which is Dickens' most serious look at industrialization and the social scene, he's not in favor of trade unionism. He thinks that that is putting a great control on workers, trying to force people to think one way. He's very much a liberal in the sense of being a libertarian. He wants the individual to have liberty, but he is in no way deceived by the rich manufacturer who claims that his workers simply want to live off turtle soup and eat off gold plates. Mm-hmm. He knows perfectly well that the workers are poor. He's not easy to categorize. He says he's so radical, he gets more radical, by which he means more left-wing and more liberal. We look at him and see him with a good deal of conservatism as well as the radicalism. He wants the individual to work up through. He's very keen on opportunities for the individual inventor, not to be bound down by the government restrictions in the patent office, which operated very slowly and very badly in his day. He's deeply opposed to incompetent government and a heavy bureaucracy, which he sees sitting weightily on the world. So he is concerned about the poor. He is concerned about people who don't understand that down at the bottom of society you will find people who are better characters than many of those at the top. He is deeply suspicious of the hereditary aristocracy and its sense that it's better than everyone else. On the other hand, people say that, you know, he's always against them. Not quite true. He also knows that they have a generosity and a charity about fallen members of their own society, which you don't find in his own class, the middle class. Mm. Fallen women in the aristocracy find that they have men like Sir Leicester Dedlock, who doesn't care if his wife's got a past. He loves her, and he just wants her saved. Everybody thinks that Sir Leicester is so posh that he will be furious. She thinks that he would be furious that she's got a past. He isn't. He loves her. Mm. Cousin Phoenix, a silly old man, really the worst sort of stupid aristocrat. When his cousin has, again, thrown away her reputation, he comes to her aid and looks after her. Dickens knew the aristocracy would do some things that his own class wouldn't.
Hmm. We go to phone calls for our guest. Tomorrow is the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens, and we're celebrating his remarkable body of work this hour of the show. Martin Fido, our guest, he's great, isn't he? Senior lecturer, Arts and Sciences Writing Program at Boston University. He's author, and it's just been, there are a lot of books out now because of the bicentenary on Dickens right now. He is the author of The World of Charles Dickens, which has just been released. Again, it was written in 96. Our number, one line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or use the email if you would like, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Martin. We've asked Martin to do a couple readings for us because it's wonderful to hear Dickens, too, and he will do that as the hour progresses. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hello. I'm so glad your guest used the term inventor. I'd like to begin my question with an example. The noted American inventor Samuel Colt went to England in the latter part of the 19th century for some kind of exposition. And while he was explaining the wonderful nature of his invention, a British man named Adams started brandishing a revolver in the crowd and claiming it was completely superior in every respect to the one made by Colt. So my question is, was there some kind of hostility or some kind of ragged-edged competition between the intellectual classes in America and in Great Britain? In particular, could I have the guest comment on what Mr. Dickens had to say about the American white female?
Ah, yes. Well, there was some tension. Dickens went to America expecting to love it as the place of democracy, freedom, everything that he thought he believed in. Initially, in Massachusetts, he felt this was the case. He loved the conditions of the working girls in Lowell. He enjoyed the city of Boston. And then, increasingly, he became disillusioned. He became tired. He became tired of being feted and having people wanting to see him everywhere. He was disgusted by slavery in the South, and gradually a sort of social snobbery also came in. He didn't like the fact that Americans chewed tobacco and had spittoons and spat everywhere. That disgusted him, as it disgusted many visitors from Europe. And he came to feel, much more dubious about America. When he published his American notes, they seemed very critical, and he had previously been very popular in America. For a moment, he was very unpopular. He was another of the British visitors who had been superior. A splendid example of the sort of tension between the Americans and Europeans comes from his great friend, William Macready, who was the leading tragic actor, Shakespearean actor, in England at the time. When Macready came to America to play Hamlet, the leading American actor, Ned Forrest, attended his performance of Hamlet with a group of friends. And there was a particular moment when Macready always gesticulated with a handkerchief, and it was a very mannered movement. And at that, Forrest and his friends hissed him.
Huh.
Macready was absolutely outraged. He fulminates about this in his diary, goes on and on about it, that such an insult had never occurred. I think that was evidence of the American actor disliking the notion that an English actor must be superior. At the time when Emerson is writing The American Scholar and saying, for God's sake, let's be proud of ourselves and not feel that we've got to try to keep up with London all the time. As for the American female, Dickens has one absolutely marvelous moment. The Transcendentalists, you would have thought, would have been people right after Dickens' own heart. They're liberal-minded, they're benevolent, they're opposed to slavery. But their ideas seem to him wild and woolly. Remember that Dickens is, for all the extravagance and fun of his writing, he's really a very down-to-earth, basically, centrally, lower-middle-class sort of man in a large part of his mind. And one Transcendentalist lady said to him in hushed tones, "I believe in the universe." Dickens thought this was one of the most absurd things he'd ever heard. He repeated it to the philosopher Thomas Carlyle, who said, "By God, she'd better."
Oh, that's funny. I read that he was, and they're having some special celebration this week, or they already had it, a friend of Longfellow's?
Oh, yes, he was indeed. Yes, he met Longfellow in Cambridge, and then when Longfellow visited London, he took Longfellow round, showed him the slums and the prisons of England. He always showed off, you know, the bad side, the sensational side. He liked sensation in his novels. He was mm-hmm. a very sensational novelist. There are prisons, there are murders, mm-hmm. Constantly operatic happenings going on in his novels. He showed Longfellow that. He was certainly one of those who regarded Longfellow as probably the greatest poet. He was a great friend of Browning's and of Tennyson's as well, and he certainly put Longfellow right up there with them.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
I'm still laughing over I believe in the universe. But I called because, whereas I like Dickens, some family and friends will say, well, his characters are cartoonish or, you know, mere caricatures of humanity, or even some people say ridiculous. And I reject that, possibly because they strike so true to me that as an American, you know, right now, economically, we're all feeling a little bit like Miss Havisham in terms of waiting for something to happen and trying not to turn our progeny's life into ice, as she did with her daughter. I just want you to address that issue of people saying, well, these are cartoons. You began by citing W.C. Fields playing Mr. Micawber, and I maintain that whether it's Charles Schulz with Peanuts or Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, which, you know, on this side of the pond is shown again and again and again every Christmas season, that these stories really ring true with us. These people are exaggerated. These characters are exaggerated. but they really show something about ourselves that we cannot escape. And I also just wanted to recommend a brief passage in Margaret Atwood's 2008 book, Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. She has a brief passage in there about Mr. Micawber, and it's indexed. And for anyone who's interested in Dickens and in their current economic situation, I'd urge them to take a look at Atwood's Payback.
Thank you, Rich. Martin?
Yes, well, I agree with Rich entirely, and I like cartoons. I like Charles Schulz's Peanuts. I like Donald Duck. So I don't mind caricature. It's an element in art. Within those caricatures, I think Dickens gets over great truths, and yet the wonderful thing about him is even when his characters are bad and evil creatures, he makes us laugh at them. Now, Mark Twain said, you know, why don't we use laughter? That is the great way of shooting down evil. The more we get het up and angry about it, the more we'll get a het up and angry response. But make people laugh at it. So what do we remember about Scrooge? Are we delighted that Scrooge becomes good and buys a turkey? No, we remember Bah Humbug, and I would like everyone who goes around saying Merry Christmas to be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a sprig of holly through his heart. Wackford Squeers, the appallingly cruel schoolmaster. Yes, Dickens brings out the horror of those ghastly boarding schools where unwanted illegitimate children and inherited stepchildren were sent to be just kept out of the way forever, and they were brutally treated, badly educated. So Squeers is a dreadful man, but oh, goodness, we want him to open his mouth and say wicked things all the time because they're so funny. There's richness for you, says Squeers, smacking his lips as he drinks some of the horrible watered milk that he gives to the boys. And he trips over his own language. She's a blessed thing, is nature, says Squeers. Oh, it's a blessed thing to be in a state of nature, quite forgetting that that was a good Victorian term for being naked. We laugh and we're horrified at the same time. And yes, many of the caricatures can show us things about ourselves because he can pull back from them. So in Scrooge, he doesn't just say, hey, he's a dreadful old miser, it's a madness. He says, through Scrooge's fiancée, you're too afraid of the world. You're building a wall of money between yourself and the world. If you would only be more open, you'd be more human. But you're afraid. You're afraid if you don't have the money, you won't be respected. He can show us these tremendous truths that we are aware of. Yes, I liked very much what Rich said.
Yes, I do too. I do too. And that, yeah. Thank you, Rich, so much for your call. Let's spend, before we go back to phone calls, a little bit of time on his life. I love to know the lives of great authors. First of all, I was dumbfounded to remember that he had 10 children, and then he left them all, which was rather appalling. Somebody has said, I can't remember where I read this, all the good, simple people in his novels are what he wanted to have been. The villains were what he was. Is that too harsh?
Yes, it's certainly too harsh. His villains, I think he drew undoubtedly on his own id, if I can be Freudian. Daniel Quilp in The Old Curiosity Shop is virtually the id having a glorious day out. Here are all my evil feelings, my wish to drink too much and to drink boiling hot brandy that no one else can drink and to eat the heads and shells of shrimps while I'm crunching everything down and to flog a statue if I can't flog the person it is and to fancy little Nell in a most ghastly erotic way. He lets all the potentially bad side of himself out into those villains. It is perfectly true that his idealized heroes, they're quite unreal. He'd have liked to be like that. And he almost seems to imagine that he was. I mean, when he was behaving appallingly to his wife when the marriage broke up, he would tolerate no criticism at all. He broke lifetime friendships, changed his publishers because people wouldn't accept the abusive things he was writing about his unfortunate wife. So, yes, and the 10 children. He managed to go on as if Kate had insisted on producing these things and landing them on him without his having anything to do with them.
Right.
He began to complain about it. I mean, he could be funny about it. He said at one point when Kate was pregnant again, she's conducting an anti-Malthusian experiment, Malthus being the early economist who had said that if our population continues to increase at the rate it's doing so, we will eat up resources. We've really got to slow down population growth. So he could laugh about it, but he was warned by one of his friends. I forget which one it was now. It could have been Browning, who said, as another child was born, he was asked to be godfather. Yes, I'll do that, but, you know, I do think that this constant bearing of shoots weakens the parent tree.
Hmm.
And he was thinking about Kate. And Dickens grumbled as if he'd got too many children and it was nothing to do with him.
Hmm. Let's go to Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was introduced to Dickens by David Cameron, who went on then to study film, but a part that stays with me from Great Expectations is the scene I often have students in a class I teach on organizations and small organizations read. It's the reading of the settlement or the will at the offices of Jarndyce and Jarndyce at the very end of the book. It's such a magnificent description, if you can call it that, of bureaucracy and double talk. It's anybody that's listened to government pronouncements or whatever lately would do well to read it, to see it at its most extreme. But I have a question about, does that ring true for you? And also, am I confusing Mark Twain with Charles Dickens, who I was visiting Hawaii and there was an inscription from their diary, one of them's diaries, over the volcano at Mauna Kea, and I'm wondering, did Dickens get that far in his travels?
Certainly Dickens never went as far as Hawaii. He went down the Mississippi, but I don't think he went much further west than that when he was in America. Now, in Bleak House, of course, the whole novel is concerned with the total confusion that the law, the writing down of the law into statutes and the interpretation of those statutes by lawyers causes, the unhappiness that it makes for all sorts of people. So that you referred also to the reading of the will in Great Expectations. One has two sets of wills, doesn't one? One has the Jarndyce will, which has been so complicated that in the end an entire huge estate is simply eaten up in lawyers' fees, and none of the heirs who've been disputing who should get it gets a penny. It all goes on the legal expenses. And in Great Expectations, we have all the dreadful hangers-on, of whom the Pockets are the nicest people, the relatives of Miss Havisham, who desperately want to inherit her money. But the Bleak House fogginess, Kathleen, you'd asked me if I would read something, and
yes.
I felt that the opening of Bleak House, with its wonderful description of fog, is a great example of how Dickens uses a powerful rhetoric to suggest something gloomy, using the image of fog as the confusion that the law is actually putting over England, and yet drops in it moments of humor as well. And he's always at his best when he gets humor in. Would you like me to read that?
The stage is yours.
Right. Opening a Bleak House in Chancery. London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. And it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in the mire, horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper and losing their foothold at street corners where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights, fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships, fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper down in his close cabin. Fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck. Chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds. Gas looming through the fog in divers places in the streets, much as the sun may from the spongy fields be seen to loom by husbandman and ploughboy. Most of the shops lighted 2 hours before their time, as the gas seems to know, for it has a haggard and unwilling look. The raw afternoon is rawest, and the dense fog is densest, and the muddy streets are muddiest near that leaden-headed old obstruction, appropriate ornament for the threshold of a leaden-headed old corporation, Temple Bar, and hard by Temple Bar in Lincoln's Inn Hall. At the very heart of the fog sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Never can there come fog too thick, never can there come mud and mire too deep to assort with the groping and floundering condition which this High Court of Chancery, most pestilent of hoary sinners, holds this day in the sight of heaven and earth. That, I think, is a wonderful creation.
Oh, Martin, wonderful. Yes.
That he's going to say society is in,
yeah,
as well as
the mud,
the weather.
The fog, the, oh, yeah. You should have you recorded all of this? You should do these books on tape.
Oh, how nice. Can you find me a publisher who will do it, and I could get some royalties for it? I'm
sure.
Hopeless of business. I've written lots of things, taped lots of things, and I never get anything back from it.
Oh, you read it beautifully. Thank you, Martin, for that. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. It's the eve of the bicentenary of Charles Dickens' birth, and we are celebrating his vast amount of work that is so important to us now and was so important to Victorian England. Martin Fido, senior lecturer, arts and sciences, writing program at Boston University. He has taught all over the world and was born in England, as you might be able to tell. His book, which has been re-released due to this special year, is The World of Charles Dickens. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Martin, Tom in Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen, and good morning, Martin. Enjoyed the reading that you just did.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring it to your attention, ask you maybe if you are familiar with The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. It starts off with a traveling troupe of jongleurs, or actually the setting is more like early England, but it's a fantasy, and the whole thing is very much centered around the power of the word and the use of language, and it's very interesting just from the standpoint of theater. But then his family is killed, and suddenly he is a homeless child at the age of 11 for 3 years, and his struggles before he goes on to other adventures. But I really have been enjoying it, and I can't put the book down.
Tom, you have the advantage of me. I don't know it at all. Tell me again the name, the title, the author, and I will make a note.
It's a trilogy. The first one is The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss, R-O-T-H-F-U-S-S.
Patrick R-O-T-H-U-S-S.
H.U. Rothfuss.
Patrick Rothfuss. Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. I will look it up. Thank you for the recommendation, but I honestly have to say I don't know it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And Rhonda said he is a Wisconsin author. Thanks, Rhonda. Mary in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Yes. I was wondering, you just read that description of the fog and is a, I guess, a metaphor or something like that. I was wondering if he was influenced by Edgar Allan Poe.
They were aware of each other. They met while he was in America. I'm not sure what the extent of the influence might have been. Certainly, like Poe, he became, and in Bleak House in particular, he became interested in the idea of a murder mystery. Certainly, they were both very interested in sensational writing. But I'm not honestly certain what the degree of influence was between the two of them. Yes, of course, as you say, that whole opening is a massive metaphor. He thinks that the corrupt administration of the law is corrupting people who, he's, obviously the idea of Great Expectations was one which was with him from early on, the idea that you might inherit a lot of money and therefore you wouldn't work, that concerned him. It's present in Bleak House, and it's the overall fog and corruption of the law, the dirt which he thinks comes from people hoping that they can simply get money by conniving and looking for inheritances. That is all imaged in this idea of a disgusting November day in London.
Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Charles Dickens' father was placed into debtor's prison, and I think that influenced his writing quite a bit. Here in America, in the last couple of weeks, Newt Gingrich, who's running for president, mentioned that he thought that it would be all right for children that are low income to take on jobs in addition to their education. What do you think that Charles Dickens' commentary on the conservative movement in England and in America today would be?
And what he would be writing, let's expand that. What would he be writing about today in America?
Yes, he certainly wouldn't want child labor brought back, and I'm sure Newt Gingrich doesn't want the sort of child labor which in the 1840s was finally abolished in England. The idea of 4- and 5-year-old children sent down in mines in the darkness with the job of pulling doors open and shut to try and keep air ventilation going on through it. The child labor in England was terrible. You will remember in the Christmas Carol that the Ghost of Christmas Present shows the children called Ignorance and Want. And Dickens says, remember them and beware the future. Now, I honestly don't think that we are at that sort of position in England today. I think that Dickens would have actually looked at both the opposing popular movements that we have and extrapolated from both of them. I think he would have said, he had learned from his father about living within your income, he would have joined the Tea Party in saying we can't support our standard of living by borrowing forever and ever. Ultimately, nations like people have got to pay their debts or they'll wind up in the Marshalsea. On the other hand, he would have felt passionately that the way in which over the last 30 years the gap between rich and poor has increased, whereas it had been steadily decreasing for the previous 100 years, he would have thought that a very bad thing. He had no doubt at all that the huge gap between the rich and poor should be brought to close as much as possible, as long as, of course, he always felt that you must be able to work your way up. He did not want a completely regimented society where you simply did what the government told you and were given a good support for that. So he sounds extreme because he has this intense rhetoric, but I think from the point of view of our politics today, he stands firmly in the middle. He wants the independent person to be able to work and to rise thereby, but he does not want that to mean that the people who've got money get more and draw away from those who haven't started with money, and he does not think that society or individuals can live by nonstop borrowing.
Mm. Thank you, Brad, for your interesting question. And what about his thoughts concerning the power of the word to right society's wrongs, Martin?
He took a pride in what he had done. Again, he referred to Wexford Squeers. He delighted in putting down people who were stupid. There was an alderman, a magistrate in London, called Sir Peter Lawrie. Suicide, of course, was illegal, and in particular, it was felt that poor prostitutes tended to try to drown themselves in the Thames. Whenever they were rescued, Sir Peter gave them enormously heavy punishments, and he said he was determined to put down suicide. He had put down suicide in London. Well, Dickens jeered at this as ridiculous, and Dickens had, in Oliver Twist, drawn attention to a dreadful area on the Thames called Jacob's Island, where the sewage-ridden Thames was used as washing and drinking water, and it became a great center of cholera.
Mm-hmm.
Because he'd put it in Oliver Twist, Sir Peter Lawrie, who didn't think that he needed to spend any money on stupid social improvements and the buildings there, said, well, Jacob's Island is only a place in a work of fiction. Dickens was delighted because he had caricatured Sir Peter Lawrie himself in the Chimes. And he said, well, Sir Peter is also a piece of a work of my own fiction. It's a pity he wasn't completely fictional. He took pride in what he achieved with his words. He said, there used to be a great many very bad schools in Yorkshire. I believe there are none now. And that was boasting. He felt he had done that with Nicholas Nickleby in exposing Wexford Squeers and Dotheboys Hall.
Interesting. And I guess we can't overstate the importance of Dickens to the whole world of literature. I mean, it's not just the Victorian era. This is somebody we read now and we read carefully now and has influenced many, many writers. Why has he been so important for so long, Martin?
Ooh, that is... Well, I suppose I'm going to start by saying because he's entertaining. Though I'm a university teacher and clearly in favor of intellectual writing, intellectuals can lose sight of the fact that the public wants to be entertained. The Harry Potter books sell because they're page-turners, and the public wants this. When Dickens became friendly with Wilkie Collins, who was a much younger, quite popular writer, Collins said, what does the public want? Make them laugh, make them cry, and make them wait. Mm-hmm. And Dickens puts that into his books. He makes us laugh, and that's his great strength. He made his audience at that time cry. Sometimes he can move us very much today. Sometimes he misses very badly, and we think that we're hearing dreadful melodrama. He lapses into blank verse, and he knew he did this when he got excited. He was too influenced by the theater in that respect. He can be hopelessly theatrical at times, and so one ceases to think he's real, but he also makes us wait. He gives us suspense. So you have our mutual friend at the end of his life. We know he intended to say that John Jasper killed Edwin Drood, but we do not know how. We do not know exactly why and what the crisis was. We can only imagine how this novel was going to end.
Hmm. Well, this has been wonderful. Will you celebrate in any special way, chocolate cake or something like that?
I've celebrated enough by having the opportunity to go back and do some rereading Dickens and thinking about Dickens for you today. It's been a great joy.
Oh, thank you, Martin. It's been a great joy to have you on the air. And I really would recommend that you tape some of those books. Your reading is quite spectacular.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Martin. Our guest this hour, Martin Fido, Senior Lecturer, Arts and Sciences Writing Program at Boston University. He is the author of the book that was first written in 1996. It has been re-released because of the bicentenary of Charles Dickens' birth, which really is tomorrow. The book is The World of Charles Dickens, The World of Charles Dickens, highly acclaimed book. And in the spirit of Dickens, we all see Christmas Carol, don't we, every year, but the line, one of the lines, many of them that I remember is, I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. So here we are, far from Christmas. It's good to remember that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this wonderful hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. The Kathleen Dunn Show is our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.